We can begin with a contradiction. On one side, philosophy is clearly a democratic activity. I shall explain why in a few minutes. On the other side, the political conceptions of the majority of philosophers, from Plato to myself, for example, by Hegel, Nietzsche, Wittgenstein, Heidegger, or Deleuze, are not at all democratic in the sense of the word, which is the more usual. I shall also soon explain this point. So, we have a contradiction between the very nature of philosophy, which is certainly a democratic conception of discussion and thinking, and the explicit conceptions of philosophy in the political field, which very often accept an authoritarian framework for the collective destiny of human beings. We have something like a paradoxical relation between the three terms: democracy, politics, philosophy. We have to go from democracy to philosophy. That is, in fact, the way of creation of philosophy by the Greeks. Democracy first, and the invention of philosophy. The birth of philosophy is clearly dependent on the invention by the Greeks of the first form of a democratic power. We have also to go from philosophy to politics. In fact, politics is certainly a major concern of philosophers all along the historical becoming of philosophy. But when politics is a reflexive object of philosophy, it is generally very difficult to go from that sort of politics to democracy. So if you want, we have something like a closed cycle. We go from democracy to philosophy. We go from philosophy to politics. But the philosophical conception of politics does not go to democracy, generally speaking. Democracy is, if you want, a necessity before philosophy, and a difficulty or an impossibility after philosophy. Our question is, what is changing in politics by the philosophical action so that democracy is first of all a necessity, and second of all, something very difficult or impossible? And our answer will be, the difficulty lies in the relation between the democratic notion of freedom and the philosophical concept of truth. In one word, if something like a political truth exists, this truth is an obligation for every rational mind. So, freedom is absolutely limited. Conversely, if there is no such limitation, there is no political truth. But then, there is no positive relation between philosophy and politics. The three terms, politics, democracy, and philosophy, are finally tied by the question of truth. The obscure note is in fact determined by the proper obscurity of the category of truth. So the question is, what is a democratic concept of truth? What is, against relativism, a democratic universality? What is a political rule which is for all of us, but without the constraint of the transcendency? But we have to begin by the beginning, by the two points. First, why democracy is a condition for the existence of philosophy? And two, why philosophy is so often inappropriate to a democratic vision of politics. Philosophy, I think, has two fundamental characteristics. First, philosophy is a discourse which is not dependent on the place of the man or the woman who speaks. If you want, philosophy is not the discourse of a king, of a priest, of a prophet, or of a god. There is no guarantee for the philosophical discourse on the side of transcendency, power, or sacred function. Philosophy assumes that the search for truth is open to everybody. The philosopher must be everybody. What he or she says is not validated, if it is, by his or her position, but only by the content. More technically, we can say that a philosophical evaluation is not about the subjective enunciation, but about the objective wording. Philosophy is a discourse without any other legitimacy than itself. But this is clearly the democratic characteristic. Second, philosophy is directly exposed to the judgment of others. In philosophy, we have anticipation of objections and critics of readers of others. You have to accept the discussion. It's something like an axiom. an axiom of equality of minds. This equality of minds is the permanent tribunal for philosophical discourse. And this is clearly a democratic condition. So, philosophy, first, is completely indifferent to the social, cultural, institutional, or religious position of who speaks or thinks. Philosophy accepts to be from everybody. And second, philosophy is exposed to approval or critique without preliminary selection of who approves or objects. Philosophy accepts to be for everybody. We can clearly conclude that philosophy from everybody and for everybody is democratic in its very essence. But, we have also to remark that philosophy, which accepts to be completely universal in its origin and in its address, cannot accept to be democratic in the same sense in its goal, in its destination. Everybody can be a philosopher, or the interlocutor of a philosopher. But it's not true that every opinion is equivalent to another opinion. The axiom of equality of minds is not at all an axiom of equality of opinions. From the beginning of philosophy, with Plato, we have to distinguish first between correct opinions, orthodoxa, and incorrect opinions, and second, between opinion and truth. If the ultimate goal of philosophy is to completely clarify the distinction between truth and opinion, it's evident that there is no real acceptation by philosophy of the great democratic principle of the freedom of opinions. An opinion which is absolutely opposite to a truth cannot have the advantage of that sort of freedom. We have, in fact, it's not only a philosophical question. We have some examples in other fields than philosophy. For example, in France, the negation of the reality of the destruction of the Jews by the Nazis is not in the field of the freedom of opinions. There is a law which forbids everybody to expose in public that sort of opinion. More generally, philosophy opposes the unity and the universality of truth to the plurality and the relativity of opinions. There is another reason for the character not absolutely democratic of philosophy. I have said that philosophy is exposed to others, that philosophy is acceptation of discussion and critics. But, for acceptation of discussion and critics. You have also to have acceptation of a rule for the discussion. You have to know what is a valid argument. You have to know what is a consequence. If something is true, something else is also true as a consequence of the first position. So, philosophy implies the existence of a universal logic as a formal condition for the axiom of equality of minds. Finally, the conviction of equality of minds as philosophically as a condition, the existence, the formal existence of a common logic. Certainly, the universality of the philosophical address to everybody implies something like a freedom, but also the constraint or the necessity of a strict common rule for the discussion. We can here take the example of mathematics. Certainly, mathematics is as philosophy from everybody and for everybody. There is no specific language. All is formal, all is consequences. But precisely, you have in mathematics a strict rule for consequences. In the case of philosophy, the search for truth and for existential consequences of truth, for vital consequences of truth, implies also the necessity of a common rule, the necessity of a logic. So, when philosophy examines politics, it cannot be first along the line of pure freedom, and certainly not freedom of opinions. Philosophy has that sort of question: what could be a political truth? What could be a political truth? Or if you want, what is politics when it obeys two principles? First, compatibility with the philosophical principle of the equality of minds. A political truth has to be compatible with the philosophical principle of the equality of minds. And second, compatibility with the philosophical principle of the subordination of the variety of opinions to the universality of truth. So for the philosopher, the characteristics of valid politics are equality and universality. The classical name of that, equality and universality, is in the philosophical field justice. In justice, equality is much more important than liberty, and it's certainly a point of disagreement between the philosophical tradition and the democratic consensus. Equality is more important than liberty, and universality is much more important than particularity identité or individualité. It is why there is a problem between philosophy and the common definition of democracy by individual liberties. Very important philosopher today, American philosopher Richard Ortiz, has said one day, democracy, I quote him, democracy is more important than philosophy. But in my opinion, the consequence of the axiom of Rorty, democracy is more important than philosophy, is a complete dissolution of philosophy in cultural relativism. We can say that at the beginning of philosophy, in the world of Plato, something is said that is exactly the contrary. The thesis of Plato is, philosophy is more important than democracy. Justice is more important than freedom. So, we have a great ambiguity of the critique of democratic politics by Plato and some other philosophers. In the case of Plato, on one side, certainly, it's an aristocratic personal position. But on the other side, it's a real problem. The problem of a sort of organic contradiction between justice and freedom. After all, it's our situation today. We can see that. The contradiction between freedom and justice. The price for our freedom in the Western world is a monstrous inequality. Inside our country, first, and much more outside. Philosophically speaking, there is no justice at all in the contemporary world. It's maybe a world of freedom, but it's not at all a world of justice. So, we have a paradoxical situation. Democracy is a condition for philosophy, but democracy has no direct relation to justice. And justice is the philosophical name for truth in the political field. So the nut of the three terms remains obscure, as it can be seen on the first diagram that you have. Democracy as a condition for philosophy. Philosophy as a determination of truth in politics. But finally, no possibility to return to democracy from the philosophically determined politics. To solve the problem, we have to take here a detour, a classical detour by mathematics, a second time. Mathematics, and many philosophers have seen that, is probably the best paradigm of justice, as Plato has seen very soon. First, in mathematics, we have a sort of primitive freedom, which is the freedom of the choice of the beginning, the choice of axioms. After that, we have a complete determination along some logical rules. So we have to completely assume the consequences of our first choice. And third, all that is strictly universal and equality in a precise sense. A proof is a proof for everybody without exception. Everybody who assumes the positive choice and the logical rules. So we have, and that is the point, choice, consequences, equality, universality. In fact, choice, consequences, equality, universality, that is something which is apparent in the classical revolutionary politics, the goal of which is justice, precisely. First, we have to assume a fundamental choice between what the Chinese revolutionaries name the two ways or the two places. Proletarian or bourgeoisie, primitive choice. Second, you have to assume the consequences of your choice, organization, hard struggle, sacrifice, no freedom of opinions and life, but discipline, hard work to find the strategic way for victory. And after that, not a democratic state in the common sense, but dictatorship of proletariat to crush the resistance of enemies. And all that is also exposed as completely universal, because the goal is not the power of a particular class or group, but, maybe fictionally, the end of all classes and inequalities, and finally, the end of the state as such. So we find in the classical revolutionary politics primitive choice, consequences, equality and universality. In this conception, democracy is in fact the name for two completely different things. And probably is the clarifying point. Democracy first is, as Lenin has said, a form of the state, the democratic state, with elections, deputies, constitutional government, president, and so on. Second, it's a form of mass action. It's popular or active democracy. Great meetings, demonstrations, riots, insurrections, and so on. In the first sense, democracy has no direct relation to revolutionary politics, no direct relation to justice, or philosophically, no direct relation to political truths. But in the second sense, popular democracy like as active democracy. Democracy is not a norm or a goal. It's not a form of a state. Democracy, it's means. A means for popular active presence in the political field. Democracy is not the political truth, but one of the means to find the political truth, or to create the political truth. It's, for example, clear in the famous, I think of that because tomorrow we begin the session about cultural revolution. The famous decision in 16 points, famous for me, but not for all of us. Decision in 16 points is written probably by Mao and his supporters during the summer of 1966. At the beginning of the Cultural Revolution. And you can find my commentary of this decision is a special issue of Positions. Very good. And you can read about the decision of in 16 points. It's page. It is the beginning. Something like that. It's a Chinese decision. Trust the nation. Rely on them. And respect their initiative. Cast out fear. Do not be afraid of disturbances. Chairman Mao has often told us that revolution cannot be so very refined, so gentle, so temperate, kind, courteous, restrained, and magnanimous. Let the masses educate themselves in this great revolutionary movement and learn to distinguish in the movement between right and wrong and between correct and incorrect ways of doing things. So, the great democracy, the democracy in the active sense, with gigantic meetings, thousands of new organizations, millions of political posters, the famous Dasibao, violent polemics, armed riots, and so on, all that, for this text, and finally for Mao, is to learn. To learn to distinguish between just way and unjust way. To learn the right into politics. So finally, to learn the correct way, philosophically translated, to learn the truth in politics. But we have seen, at the beginning of my lecture, that democracy was also one of the means for philosophy. Democracy was a condition of a new status of discourse, a status without sacred place, without sacred book, without king, priest, prophet or god, without guarantee of legitimacy. So, we can propose a new hypothesis to completely understand the obscure knot of philosophy, politics, and democracy. From the point of view of philosophy, democracy is neither a norm or a law, nor it is a goal. Democracy is only one of the possible means of popular emancipation. But discipline of consequences and maybe dictatorship are also among means, possible means of emancipation. Exactly as the constraints of mathematics are also a condition for philosophy. So, the diagram cannot be as the first diagram, but is as the second diagram that we can read now. Democracy as a condition for philosophy, democracy as a means for politics, a means for learn the popular truths in politics. Truths as the determination of justice in politics, philosophically speaking, and philosophy as determination of the existential consequences of truth. And we can see on the diagram that there is no circular possibility of inspection of the diagram. We can go from democracy to philosophy as a condition. We can go from democracy to politics as means for popular mobilization. We can go to truth to politics, it's the definition of justice. We can circulate between philosophy and truth, truth as the goal for philosophy and philosophy as consequences of truth, but we cannot go directly from philosophy to democracy. If real democracy is means of politics, we can also say that democracy is an event for political consequences. Democracy as active democracy, democracy to learn new truths in the political field, is not in the form of a state, but in the form of an event. Democracy is something which happens and not something which is. Democracy is for us the pure present between the past, the old memory of revolutionary politics, and the future of emancipation. What we have to learn in the democratic activity. And at this point, to change, not always mathematics, I think to a great American poet, Wallace Stevens, in an extraordinary poem, the title of which is Description Without Place. It's a poem in which we can find Lenin. It's very striking that an American poet quote Lenin. Stevens says, I quote, "The eye of Lenin kept the far-off shapes." The eye of Lenin kept the foul shapes. Lenin, for Stevens, is the man who keeps all the revolutionary past in his mind, in his eye. Lenin sees the foul shapes of revolutionary politics. Lenin sees the past, all the shapes of the past. And it's the first dimension of democracy. Because when we have to learn something new, we have also to have in the mind the shapes of the past. And Stevens also says, what we say of the future must portend be alive with its own cynics. What we say of the future must portend be alive with its own cynics. Democracy is always something which is said of the future, something we have to learn of the future of politics, and something which must portend, something which appears, which happens like a new life. It's not the rule of life, it's the happening of a new life in the political field. Between the far-off shapes and the future we must portend, democracy, when it happens, is not politics, but it is, for the philosopher, the promise of newness in the political field. So when democracy happens, the philosopher can say, truth is possible in the political field. Justice